This broadcast was recorded on September the 15th, 2014. Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm your host, Dave Custy, for this program called Healthcare and Its Future. My guest today is Alyssa Bantug, Program Manager of Breast Cancer Communication, Education, and Survivorship at the Johns Hopkins Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center. Alyssa is a two-time cancer survivor. After finding a lump in her breast at the age of 21, it took Ms. Bantug 18 months to find a doctor who would be willing to order a mammogram. Her first breast cancer diagnosis was at the age of 23. 2 years later, on her 25th birthday, she was diagnosed for a second time with breast cancer. Ms. Bantug is an outspoken advocate for women living with breast cancer and has firsthand experience with some of the many concerns breast cancer can create, such as coping with long-term side effects, fertility, caring for the caregiver, survivorship care planning, navigating between medical professionals, and improvement of health outcomes. She is currently involved in several research initiatives. Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio, Alyssa.
Thank you, Dave. Great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us a little short bio in your own words.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I was first diagnosed with breast cancer at the age of 23. I found a lump when I was 21, and I was newly out of college working as a health educator. I had a background in women's health and went to my GYN and said, I have a lump in my breast. And she said, women your age don't get breast cancer. So I kind of wrote it off and said, okay, well, then if she said it's nothing, she's the professional. I went back a year later for an annual exam and said, hey, that lump's still there. And she said, yeah, I really wouldn't worry about it. I went back 6 months later, so this is about a little over two years since I found the lump, and said, hey, this lump is getting bigger. It's making me uncomfortable. Can we work it up? And she was very, kind of wrote it off and said, you know, I really don't think it's anything, but, you know, if you really are persistent about it, we can do that. I went to 9 different places before someone would agree to order a mammogram. I went to different radiology centers, I should say, before someone agreed to do a mammogram through the federal government. So there wasn't an issue with reimbursement. At the time, I was working for NIH and had federal government health insurance, but I had to call 9 different centers to find somebody that would be willing to do a mammogram on me because of my age. When I finally found a center that was willing to do this, they required me to put a credit card down, which was not typical protocol, but they really felt like it was so unusual for someone my age to be diagnosed with breast cancer and to have this imaging.
And this was within 18 months, you said?
A little over 2 years, actually. Goodness. of having the lump on my breast, yeah. And so for any of your listeners who've ever had a mammogram, you know, you're sitting in a room with these paper gowns on trying to look normal, not be nervous. And they took the initial imaging and I said, do I get dressed now? I didn't know what the protocol was. And they said, well, hold off for a second. And they took me back for a second image and a third image and a fourth image. And by that time, I started to realize something was going on. When I was done, I said, you know, do you see something? And they said, well, we can't tell you that, but take these films immediately and call your doctor today. I went to my car and tried to read my own mammogram, which I had no expertise in doing that. And I saw this great big shadow on the mammogram. And I'm thinking, that's my tumor and I'm dying. When actually I was just looking at my nipple that was magnified. Oh. But it was, this is why people that aren't experts at radiology shouldn't read mammograms. But I knew right then that there was something going on. I followed up with my primary care doctor who referred me to a surgeon. I took the films with me to the surgeon's office. And she said, so this was early November.
What year?
Of 2003. Mm-hmm. And I took the films and she said, well, I don't think it's anything and these radiology centers tend to overreact. And so we should do a biopsy, but I'm getting married and moving, have a lot going on. So let's schedule it for the beginning of the year. And yeah. I said, she said like January 15th or whatever the day was. I said, do you mean November 15th? And she said, no, I've got too much going on. We really do.
So 2 months away.
2 months of waiting after I'd already waited 2 years. So needless to say, I found a different surgeon who saw me the very next day and diagnosed me with an aggressive form of breast cancer. I was 23 years old. I had recently had a baby. I was in a relationship and in graduate school and working full time. I was also the poster child for health. So I was training for a triathlon, ate almost exclusively organic food and lots of fruits and vegetables, was very healthy otherwise and was very concerned about my health. So definitely a low blow. They did the biopsy and immediately came back that I had this aggressive form of breast cancer, as I mentioned. And the next 9 months or so were really challenging. My daughter's father left, and that relationship ended. And so it was trying to figure out how to be a graduate student, how to work full time at the NIH. and had a schedule and treatments.
So did you have a support group, your family? Or?
So I don't have a lot of family that lived in the area.
Where are you from? We should have just started back
So
then.
I grew up in Montgomery County, Maryland.
Okay, so you're a Marylander.
I am a Marylander, born and raised, and spent my whole life in Maryland, except for a few years when I was at Georgetown for college, but have lived in Maryland my whole life otherwise. Mm-hmm. So most of my family does not live close by anymore. They've since moved away, but they were, you know, they'd come in when they could to help with treatment and to help with childcare and had some great friends. But a lot of it was, really good lesson in trying to schedule things and creative, scheduling treatments during lunch or at work, or, figuring out ways that I could schedule treatment, get home, take a quick nap, and then pick up my daughter. So I could be there for her. And, you know, I joked that was a year we ordered a lot of Chinese takeout and pizza because it was, you know, that the side effects from treatment were really hard. I remember one time that we were trying to grocery shop and it was a Sunday afternoon and my life had to be very regimented. So, you know, to try to fit everything in. And it was before treatment. I often said I had no time for anything. And then you kind of put a diagnosis of cancer on and it throws everything out of whack. But I remember grocery shopping and filling the cart, you know, having the cart completely filled up and just not even having the energy to check out. So everything was bought, including frozen things. And I just could not physically, I sat down in the store and started crying and said, I can't do this. So it was really a low blow, to try to, you know, being a single parent and do everything else. But, a really good lesson on who you can depend on and realizing how strong I was under not great circumstances.
Yeah, that's terrific.
And also realizing that there were a lot of not good resources for young women with cancer. So
I was just thinking when you're saying that this is a good precursor for what you do now.
Yeah. So I had my radiation oncologist was wonderful, and she said, you know, you really need to find people your age to relate to, and had been hearing all along that women my age don't get cancer. So there weren't very many of us, and had tried a few things online. It really wasn't for me, and went to a support group. You know, and this particular support group met at noon on Tuesdays, and I laughed and I said, you know, who can do something like this at noon on Tuesdays? But I went, and when I went there, there were a bunch of women that were literally my grandmother's age talking about, you know, picking grandkids up next Wednesday, like 8 days from then. And I'm thinking, I have 25 things I need to do before noon today. Yeah. What are you talking about? And I had a really hard time relating to them. And, you know, I often tell patients that a lot of the issues that breast cancer patients face isn't unique to age. So they run the gamut regardless if you're 18 when you're diagnosed or 85 when you're diagnosed. But there are some unique issues that definitely affect younger women. And so I had all kinds of issues with body image and trying to figure out how to date after cancer. And I had fertility concerns. And so some of the treatments that they were recommending, there was a possibility of it making me infertile. And what do I need to do? What could I do about that? Mm. So there were lots of challenges along the way beyond the initial issue of being diagnosed with breast cancer. So it was a really long 9 months, but we got through it, and I thought I was doing pretty well. I also took that opportunity to use this kind of as a Pollyanna thing, where thinking, I really want to kind of be the voice for women who don't have as many resources as I do, and start speaking out about some of the unique needs of women living with breast cancer, specifically younger women. So started getting involved in doing that. And about a year to the day of me finishing radiation treatment for my breast cancer, I was diagnosed with a recurrence. And I will tell you that, like a lot of women, I was very highly anxious. I was the type of woman that was literally doing breast exams every day in the shower. I woke up thinking about cancer. I went to bed thinking about cancer. And everything in between was about cancer. I really thought that I was going to die. I had a good prognosis, scientifically speaking, but I really was so highly anxious. I remember doing things like when I put my clothes away for the winter, I remember thinking I've got to organize them a little bit neater because this may be the last winter that I'll be putting my clothes away and people have to be able to organize things. I remember doing things like writing books so my daughter would remember me, which really there was not a lot of grounding evidence that I wasn't going to live beyond this diagnosis, but that's how I internalized it. Mm-hmm. It was a really fearful time for me. So I had this recurrence and about 18 months from my initial diagnosis.
So your initial diagnosis was when you were 23.
Right.
And then they said when you were about 25
that
you had cancer.
Birthday. Yeah, I have a recurrence.
It was when you were 25th birthday?
It was my 25th birthday. I got re-diagnosed with breast cancer again. And at this point, they said we need to be more aggressive. This cancer clearly is not responding to the treatment that we've recommended. And they're recommending at least a unilateral one-sided mastectomy. So I was 25 and being faced with the idea of losing my breast and all these other things. So then we were going to have to be talking about things like more fertility concerns, losing my hair, losing my breasts, all these other challenges that, you know, you really don't think about when you think about cancer that affects young people. So I went to a surgeon here in Baltimore, and he was known for being a very good surgeon. And I went to him And it was a few days after my 25th birthday, and had been pretty well educated about breast cancer, had been doing a lot of research and working with some nonprofits and doing some advocacy projects. So knew enough to know how to ask the right questions. And I went to him and said, you know, I understand we're going to need to do a one-sided mastectomy, that the area has been radiated. It's not responding to treatment. This is multifocal disease, which means the cancer's in several places in my breast. So I understand we need to do that. But can we talk about doing something what's called nipple-sparing surgery, which at the time was pretty unique, where they actually leave the nipple intact, but then remove the tissue underneath it. Mm-hmm. And he said, absolutely not. And then I asked him if we could do the incisions underneath my breast, which would mean that instead of having incisions to go directly across my breast, could they do them underneath the breast so every time I looked in the mirror, it wouldn't be a constant reminder. You know, I expressed the idea that I felt a little bit like I was wearing a scarlet letter. Every time I looked in the mirror, I was kind of cursed with this thing. It was a constant reminder. And he looked at me and he said, "Miss Thorner, are you a topless dancer?" And I thought, no, of course I'm not. I'm not, you know, I work at NIH. I'm a researcher. Yeah. And he said, 25. He said, "So you don't take your clothes off for money?" And I said, no, I just, you know.
What kind of a question is that? Jeez.
And you know, I thought he was joking. I really didn't kind of get it. And I said, no, you know, I just really, you know, with the aesthetics, I'm 25 and I'm not a particularly vain person, but this is kind of a low blow to me and I'm dating. And it's less about what other people think than for what I think. And so I don't have to be reminded of cancer every time I take mm-hmm. my clothes off. And he said, "Miss Thorner, it doesn't matter where I do the incisions, because the only people that will see this are you and anybody you take your clothes off for. So you do your job of getting better and let me do my job." And I think that was probably the lowest of the low, that I felt like I had done everything right up until I got diagnosed with cancer, and then I did all the treatments, and it was pretty extensive. I had a lot of side effects from treatment, and I felt like I did everything right, and this still happened. So that was really very challenging, trying to figure out how to move beyond this diagnosis. And I was still experiencing some side effects from my initial diagnosis, and the fatigue was still really bad. And so I'm a pretty high energy person to begin with. And the fact that I'd have to nap every day or couldn't get through a day or couldn't plan things because I didn't know how I was going to be feeling was so hard. My friends were young and drinking in bars and going out partying, and or even little things like taking my daughter to the playground. It was just really, really hard to not have that kind of level of predictability in my life.
So what did you tell yourself? I mean, you say that you're constantly aware of it, of course, when you're in the shower or anything like that. But you had to tell yourself something to get through it.
Yeah.
I mean, because a lot of the times it sounds like it was just you and your child.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, one of the things is it wasn't finite. So I knew that there was going to be an end in sight, that this couldn't go on forever in the sense that I wasn't going to be a habitual patient. And I think that was really reassuring, that you know, kind of baby steps and celebrating small miracles. So I was literally like a little kid where I would cross off the days on a calendar, literally with an X, that many more days of treatment, that many more days of radiation, this many more doctor visits, this many more reconstruction appointments. So, you know, celebrating small things and doing things for myself to celebrate those things when I would reach those milestones, which seems kind of silly, but I needed goals to look forward to. And also in terms of my energy level and side effects, like I would say things like, going from doing triathlons to not being able to walk up a flight of stairs, saying, okay, well, today I may take the elevator, but tomorrow's the day that I'm going to do the stairs. And then the next day is the day that I'm going to walk around the block, and then maybe two blocks. And then, you know, trying to be patient with myself, knowing that I had some good days and some bad days, but knowing I could start over again and going a little bit further and pushing myself a little bit further. You know, I've always been pretty hard on myself. But trying to set goals and exceed them. So, you know, and I went from not being able to walk up a flight of stairs to going back to doing triathlons, to setting these athletic goals and fitness goals and health goals. So I could get back to being healthy.
It's amazing. You went through, in your 25 years there, you went through what people went through when they were 60, but had life experiences with them too.
Yeah.
So you had to handle all that, such like that. So, which is good, I guess, good training, like I mentioned a little bit earlier, for what you're doing now.
Well, and getting back to what you were just saying in terms of good training, it also taught me to not sweat the small stuff. I would love to say that I don't get angry at traffic anymore and I don't get, you know, angry at the little. That doesn't happen. But I think that it definitely put life in perspective for me. So it made me value what's really important. And, you know, I don't get angry as much as I used to. I don't get, you know, frustrated with little things as much as I used to. It really is kind of grounding that these lessons that some people have to wait till they're 60, 70, and 80 years old to learn. In some ways, I was very fortunate that I could kind of see this. The other thing that I really had to become an expert with was navigating the medical community and being my own advocate. So starting even before I was diagnosed and kind of saying, no, I want that mammogram. You know, I think back, if I would have waited till I was 40, which is when the recommendation is when you start mammogram, I may not be here today if I had waited those extra several years to be diagnosed. So being an advocate then, and then throughout the process, you know, I think just there's lots of bureaucracy with being diagnosed and all the mm-hmm. different doctor's appointments and different things you need, and saying, hey, I don't need to be treated that way, or hey, you know, I'm a patient too, and kind of this idea of patient-centered care, with which launched me into kind of my work now, and saying that I got really good medical care, and I often say that my doctors did a really good job of removing the disease, but they didn't necessarily do a good job of treating the whole person and getting me well.
But you had to be proactive throughout the whole thing.
Absolutely. But I remember doing things like asking my medical oncologist, what should I be eating during treatment? Are there things that are, you know, I should be avoiding? Are there things that will actually help with some of the side effects? And he said, you know, we got a very simple statement of like, eat a healthy diet. And I was, you know, thinking, what does that look like? Is that, you know, the food pyramid, or what should I be doing mm-hmm. that's considered a healthy diet?
You had been doing that.
I had been doing that. Exactly. Or what, you know, what should I be doing in terms of exercise? Are there things that are contraindicated because of the surgeries that I've had? Or should I be working through the fatigue? Is that supposed to be helpful, or is that going to make it worse? Things like sleeping. They would say, well, I'll take naps. And I would say, okay, but then I can't sleep at night. And they would say, well, here's a prescription for a sleep aid. Let me, you know, and it was that kind of thing.
So their response was minimal then.
It was extremely minimal.
When I finished, in terms of what you're talking about, in terms
exactly.
of the lifestyle that you have to have now.
And when I finished treatment, I had a very tearful last visit with my oncologist, who originally I had a very, I loathed this man. He was really very challenging to work with. But at some point in the middle of my treatment, I don't know when this happened, he became a safety net for me. And we developed this relationship beyond small talk of how are the kids and what's your wife up to. It really became, I really depended on him. And valued not only his medical opinion, but also valued the relationship and his knowledge of my body and what was going on through treatment. And so without me even realizing it, I've developed a dependency on him. So one of the last days of treatment, I said, so what's next? What should I be doing in terms of the next stages of my life? Am I more at risk for other cancers? Are there things that I should be doing to stay healthy? I thought I was doing everything right. Mm-hmm. Clearly, there were other things that I may or may not have been able to be doing. And he gave me a hug and he said, I hope you have a nice life. And I said, what do you mean? What are you talking about? And he said, well, we're done here. You should go out and celebrate. And that sounds like something I should have been excited about. Like I had been kind of, I graduated or I've gone to the next step. I don't need him anymore. And it was actually one of the most terrifying days of my whole cancer experience. Mm. That this man that I had developed this dependency with all of a sudden was kind of cutting the cord and saying, you don't need me anymore. This was someone who
there's still gray matter out there that you haven't addressed or he hadn't addressed.
Right. And this is somebody, there were times where I was seeing him daily and all of a sudden he was saying, we're done. Without even checking with me. There was no conversation about this and no relationship. It was just kind of saying, you don't need me anymore. Have a nice life, which was really scary. And so I went back to my primary care doctor after all of this was going on. And I said, I was very organized. I said, this was my diagnosis. These were my treatments. What do we need to be doing going forward? And he said, well, I don't know. And I said, well, I don't know either, but I know that early detection saves lives. So let's order a brain MRI and a bone scan and a head CT and a full body scan.
He said, I don't know.
He didn't know. And, you know, I don't think we can fault him on that because we don't really do a good job of training our primary care doctors. There's so many different kind of cancers out there and so many different types of follow-up care that's necessary that we can't expect our primary care doctors to know everything that needs to be done, every test that needs to be ordered for all the different types of cancer.
But still, you would think that he would suggest somebody else to do that, not just, I don't know.
Or let's find out. Let's
let me
figure that out. So, you know, I felt like I was kind of running the ship at that point, and I had no idea. So,
The ship the whole point.
Well, and I really thought that this was like, we should just start scanning everything. And the result of that was that all these unnecessary tests exposing me to unnecessary radiation, and then things would show up that are just very normal, but that they had to work up, and it was high anxiety producing because we had to work this up. And so I'm thinking that spot in my head, that's definitely brain cancer. And when it is nothing, but because they ordered the test, we had to follow it. So you had this idea of phantom things that were out there that we had to respond to. So I think that's part of the reason that I started doing the work that I'm doing, that we weren't doing a good job of educating our patients what they need to do, as well as providers, about what follow-up care should look like. About a little over 6 years ago now, I started working for someone named Antonio Wolf.
Well, let's back up just a little bit. When he said goodbye to you.
Yeah.
Then what?
So that was the last time I actually saw him, and I went on to see my primary care doctor without the necessary tools. So it took a long time to figure out what needed to happen.
And you were cancer-free?
I was cancer-free at that point. I had finished all my treatments, and there was no follow-up care that was needed at that point from an oncology standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So if I started talking to other survivors who were experiencing a lot of the same anxiety that I had about what the follow-up care should look like, the other thing is that I felt like I should be excited about the fact that I'd finished treatment, where actually I was terrified. Once again, this idea of constantly worrying about a recurrence. So every time I had a headache, I'm thinking, that's it, my cancer's gone in my brain, and that's the ballgame. And every time, even if I'd had a hard workout and my bones or joints were achy, I was like, oh my gosh, my cancer's gone all over my body, and now it's in my knees and my back. And so I didn't even know what a recurrence really looked like. I mean, I had heard, you know, kind of anecdotal stories from people who had said, I had breast cancer and it spread to my hip or to my lumbar spine or to my brain. And I kind of knew the pathology that breast cancer usually spreads to. So that's why I was kind of very highly anxious. But at no point was I ever given any education about what good follow-up care looked like from a surveillance standpoint with cancer, but also from an overall health and wellness standpoint.
This is amazing to me because this was only 10 years ago.
Right, exactly.
This is this century.
Yeah. And in fact, I would say the vast majority of patients around the country don't get any follow-up care still to this day. So it's definitely very challenging. So at Johns Hopkins, we about 6 years ago, we got initial funding from Susan G. Komen, Maryland, to start looking at what good survivorship care would look like. We had no idea what that meant. So it was this idea of taking thought leaders from different disciplines, so the School of Public Health, the School of Medicine in Oncology, and the School of Nursing, and saying, what do we need to be doing from a patient standpoint to be educating patients about what they need to be doing, as well as what do we need to be telling our providers about what they should be doing in terms of follow-up care? How should we be educating oncologists about how they need to transition patients, as well as educating them to start those conversations very early about when the transition will occur, as well as educating primary care providers about what they need to be doing and knowing about taking care of breast cancer patients going forward. We know that 1 in 8 women will get breast cancer in their lifetime, so primary care doctors are going to see them. Internists will see them in their clinic. And the reality is a lot of their long-term health needs aren't very different than the aging population of women, but we need to educate them of what to be doing as well as what not to be doing. So these ideas of ordering head CTs and bone scans.
I've always found that very important, what not to do.
Right, which is just as important as what to do, that we need to be able to educate our providers as well as patients too. So they need to know that this idea that, yes, early detection saves lives when you're looking for mammogram screenings and breast cancer, but the idea of scanning the whole body and running blood tests and bone scans and other things like that without any evidence of that, it's contraindicated, and there's no evidence that that really detects recurrences early or saves life. We started this program 6 years ago with the idea, we had no idea what it was going to look like, and the money was there to kind of get people together and start the conversation. And it slowly morphed into this idea of how do we do this? How do we operationalize the idea of good survivorship care? A few years after we started, offering what we call transition visits. So this idea of sitting down with a patient, about an hour-long visit, doing what's called a treatment summary, kind of going through everything that they have gone through with their treatment, as well as coming up with a survivorship care plan. So that's the idea of screening and surveillance, other health wellness needs that are needed, so things like a pneumo vaccination, a flu shot, cholesterol screenings, pap smears, colonoscopies, those types of things, as well as wellness activities, so kind of health and healthy eating and exercise and stress reduction, those types of things. So being able to educate patients and the idea of patient activation so they can drive the bus. But the other piece of that is having providers that they can go to. So the idea of having people that they can transition to. You know, our oncologists are really great about saying that you may not need to see me all the time, but I'm still your doctor. I'll always be your doctor. You can come back and see me if you need to. We think that's really important. The other thing is having that conversation at the beginning of treatment so patients don't feel abandoned like I did. We're saying, you know, I will see you for X number of months or years, depending on the type of cancer you have and the treatment that you've received. But at some point, you won't need to come back and see me all the time, that we'll be able to have a primary care provider be able to manage some of these things going forward. So we thought that was really important. The other piece of that was educating patients. So we tried to figure out the best ways to educate patients on cancer survivorship issues. And some of those topics are particularly very sensitive. So I take the topic of something like sexuality. A patient may be experiencing all kinds of sexual side effects after treatment, but may not be comfortable talking to his or her oncologist about some of these issues. So being able to provide this information when patients are ready to receive it. The other piece of that is that sexuality may not be the first thing you're worried about. Most people are worried about whether they're going to live or die, but it may be something that is a quality of life issue that you experience 6 months, 9 months, a year after treatment, that you want to get back to kind of living your life. So providing that education, what that looks like. And so we started very simply about just getting a very interactive website together. And then we realized that not everybody learns that way. And not everybody wants to read paragraphs on a website. So we started creating videos where it was me sitting down with different providers and in 8 minutes, 10 minutes or less, doing interviews with them and saying to our dietitian, what do patients need to be eating after treatment? What should they not be eating? Are there things that really help patients eat a healthy diet? Should they be eating organic? Should they avoid alcohol? Should they be doing other things like that? What's kind of the evidence base in a nutshell of what patients should be doing? We've done about 65 of those videos with different types of providers at Johns Hopkins and in the community, which has been really great to get those out. And so the idea is that people have access to that information regardless of where they're being treated. The other thing that's been pretty exciting that I've been working on the last 2 years is this idea of having patients have access to the world-leading experts in cancer and cancer survivorship. So doing webinars where we would do a 30-minute presentation on a specific topic and then letting patients or caregivers or even healthcare providers call, email in questions or call in questions and have them answered in real time on the air. And so having access to some of these people and ask, get your questions answered without having to have a medical appointment, which has been really exciting. They told me when we started webinars, if 10 people participate, it'll be a good thing. And, and the first webinar we did, you know, 2 days into it, we had 500 people register.
Wow.
So there's quite the need for it, we found. And, you know, it was really interesting. We were able to reach places that I never thought possible. You know, we were getting emails from people in Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan and saying, they don't do anything like this where I'm from. Or even in places in rural America where they said, you know, my doctor doesn't do anything. There's one oncologist in my whole area. And he or she is just kind of doing what I need to do to stay alive, but isn't looking at these other things about overall health and wellness. You know, I often say it's really important to kind of get busy living in the next steps after treatment. And it's not just enough to leave people cancer free, but we've got to kind of give them the tools that they need to live a healthy and happy life.
No, that's what I want to do here, actually. I'm just starting out, so everything's recorded, but I'll be going to live shows and conducting forums. So something like that, we could probably maybe talk down in a later day, down the road a bit about continuing this, because this is an introductory anyway, and I want to continue this.
Sure.
Let's move back just a little bit. When you first started 6 years ago, you had a unique perspective about having cancer in your mid-20s.
Yeah.
But did you collaborate with people that had cancer in 50s and the 60s, and then you combined and did this blueprint or guidelines for it. So we're saying this is what you, when you're 25 and this happens, this is a different thing than when you're 55.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I think some of the issues that cancer survivors face are not unique to regardless of your age, whether you're 23 or 25 like me or you're 85. And there is definitely those common bonds that we all experience, those fears of recurrence and some of the side effects from treatment. Those are pretty standard across the board. But I know that I have a very specific story and very my experiences are unique to me. So there was a lot of talking to people, running focus groups, talking to patients. And the other thing that I didn't mention that we did on our website was me sitting down with survivors and saying, pretend like the cameras aren't even rolling. Tell me how things are going back to work after cancer's over. Tell me how your sex life is. Tell me how it is talking to your kids or your grandkids about kind of the next steps. What is it like to feel like you're done, but you're not really done, and you're living with this fear and anxiety? And just talking to people, different types of survivors. So women who've been done with treatment for 20 years or more and hearing their experiences and some of the lessons that they've learned and some of the fears that they still continue to experience, that you kind of this idea that lose faith in your body and you may never get it back or that it gets better with time. Also young women or women who partner with women or women who are newly diagnosed or African-American women. So these types of groups and talking to women about their experiences and how we can help shape our program. And we also know that, that's something that's continually evolving. So our program at Johns Hopkins, we're continually doing that, not just for quality assurance, but how we can develop new programs that best meet the needs of all of our patients. And there's not a one-size-fits-all model.
It's constantly evolving.
Absolutely. And I think that's really important. So how we can do the best job for all of our patients, regardless of where they are, and meet them where they are. There are some patients that come in and they literally have books and books. I know for me, I literally printed out 500 articles on breast cancer and read everything. And I was really, you know, because that was my background. I had a science background, and that's what I wanted to know. And for me, that was control, that if I could kind of micromanage every little thing that I had control over, it helped the process. But there are definitely patients that I work with that say, first, I want to know if I'm going to live or die, and then tell me what treatment I need to do, and I'll do it. And kind of they put their nose down in the sand, and they just get through it. And those are, we have to be respectful of that, too. So providing information when people are ready to receive it in a variety of different formats has been really helpful, I think. You know, I remember someone saying to me, oh, I gave you that handout once. And I said, you did? I didn't remember. And I went back, and I had this whole bag of probably 50 or 60 or 80 brochures. I don't know. People gave me. And I have no recollection of any of those things. You know, we know that patients only retain about 10% of what they hear in a doctor's visit. So providing other modalities that they can go back and get that information when they're ready to receive it is so important.
Yeah. It's important too. About your 65 videos you said you had?
Yeah.
And people can see it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's very good. And then you can put it up anytime you want to.
And hear from other people too. So the ones that we have with other patients, right, they can relate to that.
That was my next question.
Sure.
With the people that you talk to and advise this, do they have a network where they can talk to like people like yourself?
Yeah. So we definitely have different...
On an ongoing basis?
Yeah. So there are lots of, there are definitely support groups in the community we refer people to. Johns Hopkins has a fantastic support program. So it's survivors offering support to one another. So it's a one-on-one peer support-led program. We have that as well. And I think I spend a lot of my day talking, a large part of my day listening to people's stories. And it's a lot less about me offering advice than me. Just, I think people want to share their stories and share what they've been through and having someone to vent and someone who understands. So,
sure.
I think I hear from patients a lot, like my kids or my husband's kind of thinks I should be done with this. And why am I still crying? And why can I not kind of move on to the next step? But I'm really scared, or I'm really depressed, or I'm really anxious. And I get that. I totally get that. And I can tell them with real assurance that it will get better. It usually gets better the further out you get from treatment. The same thing with things like fatigue. When I was in it, I thought, this is my new normal, my new reality, that I need to accept the idea of having to nap and going to bed at 8 o'clock on a Saturday night. And I can tell people that usually about a year after a treatment, that slowly starts getting better. But kind of being there and living that experience and being able to share that with them, I think is really helpful.
But you went through most of it by yourself too, and there were people out there that do the same thing to find that inner strength. But even people in the biggest families are alone about it too. Mm-hmm. So you have to really do it on an individual basis.
Sure.
And you keep it as an ongoing thing, right?
Yeah.
So 10 years after they're cancer-free, they still call you up, or they still, or maybe they help other people too.
Absolutely. People definitely get involved at different stages, and some people find it very cathartic to kind of give back. And I also, personally, I find that when I talk to a newly diagnosed patient, it's one of the most favorite things that I do in my job, because I like listening and I like helping other people, but it also selfishly reminds me how far that I've come, that I'm not the patient anymore that's doing breast exams every day in the shower, and I'm not the one that every time I get a headache, the first thought is cancer. It's, I start thinking about other things that may have caused a headache. And so it reminds you, sometimes the incremental, that you don't realize the day-to-day changes or the growth that have occurred.
But all of a sudden you say, I wasn't thinking of cancer, just saying it could have just been a headache.
Yeah. And so over the years you can see it evolve, which is really, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. And to see other patients do that. So sometimes I see patients that are really struggling with treatment, either emotionally or physically, and to see them, 3, 6, 9 months later, and they're doing well, it's amazing to see. It's incredibly rewarding to know that.
It must be very gratifying,
it
too.
Is.
You
it's think, really
it's, you know,
yeah,
the terrific yeah. just to touch another person's life.
It is. And to work at a place where everybody is kind of concerned about overall patient wellness is really, really amazing. To be around people every day that are so dedicated, the doctors and the nurses that I work with, they never say things like, it's Saturday night, I'm not dealing with that, or it's the evening, or they'll have to wait till Monday. I mean, they're so dedicated, the amount of time and effort, and the fact that they're still touched by these patients. None of them have gotten cold, or they still get very emotional about some of these diagnoses and these patients, which is amazing to see, the human aspect of it, which is great.
Well, maybe that was the problem with your oncologist.
Yeah.
And he kind of got cold and inured by the whole thing, which is understandable if he sees so many, but still to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
I've had that kind of experience in terms of when my parents were dying. Such a way, there were some people in there that came in. They had very good care.
Yeah.
But there were some that just came in. I do my job. I'm out
very
of here.
Very matter of fact.
And that's it, which is okay.
Yeah.
It's fine. But if I ask you a question, just give me a trifle more detail about
Let's go. And you can't underestimate the difference of a hug or just a pat on the back. I mean, those kinds of things to show that you care, or even the eye contact.
It's gentle touching of a hand.
It's huge.
It's fine that you found that at 25, and it took me over 50 years to do that, because I remember when I was young, my father said, what is the biggest disarming of a person is a smile.
Yeah.
And when I was in high school, I said, well, come on.
Of course.
What are you talking about, really? But I found that now,
It makes a big difference.
It really
does.
It
makes a big difference.
Really,
and the whole experience. So, asking patients about how was parking today, or how was traffic, or, no
just
one ever asked me.
Just mundane things.
Or how are things at home? I mean, I think that a lot of our patients say things like, how are your kids doing with all this? Or how is the caregiver doing with us? Which is a whole other area that is definitely something that's of interest to me, that I think the caregivers really don't get the attention. One thing that I didn't mention in my story is that the year that I was cancer-free from my first diagnosis to my second diagnosis, my mother got diagnosed with breast cancer.
Okay.
So she had breast cancer when I was a child, and I lived through that, which was really scary, and then had a recurrence 19 years later. And so being the caregiver in some ways was a lot harder. It was very powerless where I felt like, you know, I couldn't control the situation. And it was so hard. And so I have the utmost respect for these caregivers that come in and come day in and day out in our punching bags, and they're insurance navigators, and they're the taxi driver. And, you know, and it's, I know for me, there were days where I would say things like, why didn't anybody ask me how I'm feeling? Don't they know that I'm sick and I have cancer? Mm-hmm. And there were other days where I was like, why did everybody ask me how I'm feeling? Why don't they just
weigh both?
Yeah. It is. It's so hard. I mean, I think in some ways being a caregiver is just as hard, if not harder, than actually living with the disease.
Now that brings up an interesting point. Are there networking or is there forums that caregivers can talk to each other?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that we're looking into at Hopkins and actually trying to develop a caregiver corner or coffee with caregivers. And
there are,
because I think that they really don't have outlets. And I know that some of the caregivers that I work with will say things like, I feel bad going to the gym after work because I feel like I need to be there. I've been gone all day. Mm-hmm. Or I feel like I just need to get out of the house and go have a drink, or I need to go do this on the weekend. And they feel guilty. They feel like they should be there.
It's a job, you just can't leave it at work.
Right. But then they feel bad, but then at the same time, there's no self-care that goes on. And when they do these things, they view themselves as being selfish. And I feel like you have to take care of you. If you can't take care of you, you can't take care of anybody else. But that's really, really hard. And to find that balance about when it's appropriate to do that and communicating your needs, even to the patient, is really critical. Some patients really want their caregiver to go in there and take notes and to be actively involved. And then I've seen other patients that say, like, why are you asking questions? This is my thing. And so being able to try to navigate that is really hard.
They do need to do something just for themselves, at least once a week or something like that, just to get away from it.
I think it's so important. Yeah, there's a great book. A friend and colleague, his name is Mark Silver, wrote a book called The Breast Cancer Husband, and he talks all about interviewing patients and caregivers about how challenging it is and how everybody's experience is a little bit different, but that trying to find the way to do that. And even he's a caregiver himself, and talking about the own mistakes he made along the way, it's really fascinating to hear.
Well, let's go back to you a little. After you were cancer-free for a while, tell us about your life then.
So after I was, that's a good question. So I met somebody while I was in treatment, and who was amazing. And when we were dating for a while, and I kind of said, you know, listen, my daughter doesn't need a father. I don't need instant family. I don't need anybody to take care of me. And I've always been a very independent person. You know, I'm very clear, I'm not a charity case, and I will never be a charity case. So, but I had a recurrence. He said, I'm moving in. And I said, no, you're not. And he said, yes, I am. And you can either pick how this is going to go. I'm either going to pitch a tent on the front yard or moving in. And he literally pitched a tent on the front yard, which is pretty amazing. So that boyfriend now is my husband, and we have a daughter together. I have two children, and
it's amazing. Do you think about doing a screenplay for this? Like the movie? It would be great. Got to like say anything.
Yeah.
He holds up the boom box.
He's definitely a keeper. He's wonderful. So, so we were.
How long after your all clear, did he come into the picture?
So we met shortly after my initial diagnosis.
Oh, yeah. So it wasn't too long.
It was not. And then we kind of dated, and I kind of kept him at arm's length and said, listen, you know. And in retrospect, I did a really poor job of communicating my needs. And that's one of the things that I think back about, that I didn't do a good job of saying what I needed and when I needed it. Me personally. Yeah. And I would say things like, I don't want you involved. I don't need you. And kind of like doing this very strong thing. And then he would come over.
That's understandable. You were all over the place.
I would. But, you know, I think back on these things where I would do things like he would come over and I would feel like I had to look perfect and I'd cook dinner and be like a superwoman and all these things. And then I, you know, at no point did I ever kind of say, these are what I need from you. I'm never good at that. So, and then I would be resentful that I would go to the doctor and he wouldn't offer to go with me, or he wouldn't offer to be the, you know, ask how it went and things like that. So I was giving all kinds of mixed messages. And, you know, at the time I just was.
Something like that, it's easy to overthink.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. And it changes day to day, right? Mm-hmm. So there was, like I mentioned, there were some days where, you know, he wouldn't ask how I was feeling. And I would say, you know, clearly he can't even deal with the fact that I have cancer. And then other days he would ask how I'm feeling. And I'm like,
you're so wonderful.
Right. I can't win, right? Is that the story between men and women?
But it sounds like you found an amazing guy.
Yeah.
It's like just, you had a child already, too.
Yeah. And he embraced her in fact, when we got married, he did vows with her, too, and said, you know, it's a package deal, and I very much accept it, which is wonderful. Yeah. So, as you met, you asked a question, it was How's my life changed? So I got married. We had another daughter who will be 5 next month.
Wonderful.
And the program at Hopkins is growing. And I had no idea when I came on part-time 6 years ago it was going to take out of this life. But it's been really amazing to watch. It's been amazing to watch the difference we've had with people and the way the providers and patients have responded to it. And I feel like it's only going to go in one direction, which has been really amazing. So,
well, that's my next question.
Okay.
It's a good segue. How do you see the program progress in the next 3 to 5 years?
Yeah. So, I think we definitely want to expand it. So as I mentioned, there are all these things that I wanted and needed through treatment I didn't feel like I got. So I think that the idea of providing more psychosocial support is critical. From the time of diagnosis all the way through long-term survivorship, and not just for the patient, but for the entire family. So in my mind, the idea of having more resources for patients where they have access to support groups and social workers, and making sure that caregivers have those resources and kids. I mean, I think that's the other thing, is whether they're kids or grandkids, having that support system is so important to be able to educate them about what's going to happen, as well as how they can be supportive going forward, and also giving them an outlet of where they can share their fears. I think a lot of caregivers and kids don't want to say, look, I'm really scared that mom's sick, or caregivers saying, I know it's not about me, but I'm terrified my wife, who's the glue of my family, is going to die, could die, and what am I going to do? So kind of finding ways to express that, I think, is really important.
Mm-hmm. I think with that's each case that comes up, it's something more to put in the guidelines.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And I think more holistic, whole patient-centered care is really, really important. So not just removing the cancer, but the idea beyond something like a social worker, looking at holistically how patients are exercising, rather than saying you could get fat during treatment, so work out. Say, what do you like to do? And maybe it'd be great to have a walking group with other survivors. So rather than the idea of sitting in a support group around and sharing fears or experiences, the idea of doing something more active, or doing yoga classes, or maybe you like to ballroom dance, or whatever that looks like. So finding ways that works with your life. The same thing with diet and nutrition, the idea of going forward of incorporating diet into healthy eating, and how you can do that given your limitations with treatment and your taste changes with treatment. And your energy levels, so those kind of things. So doing more holistic care with nutrition, with exercise, with social work, with families, I think it's going to be really critical going forward. And the idea of putting our, kind of the idea of wrapping our arms around patients from the minute they walk in the door with a new diagnosis, and saying it's not over when we say it's over. So the experiences from treatment through the end of life if it's advanced cancer, or through long-term survivorship, and providing that care for when patients are ready to receive it.
Sounds great. Getting every aspect.
And we have all these other really exciting things coming down the pipeline, like we're trying to develop an app right now where patients will have access to things like recipes and be able to chronicle their side effects so we can intervene earlier, which is really important, and look at other quality of life measures going forward. Also a way to do research in some of these areas so we can improve care, I think, will be critical going forward, and ways that we can incorporate different exercise things where we can email out to people on a blast, and competitions, and as well as additional webinars and other ways of providing information. Also envisioning going forward that we'll have ongoing different educational programs on campus, not just electronically, where people, regardless of where they're being treated, will have access to educational groups or seminars or workshops as well.
Now, you said it's important that people get all the information they can. Do you collaborate with other cancer centers in the area?
We do, with research, as well as I've got colleagues at most area hospitals in Baltimore around the country, and we're always sharing ideas. And for instance, when we do webinars, I send an email blast to a lot of my colleagues in the area and saying, hey, could you promote this to your patients? So this is not a Hopkins initiative. This is something that we think is good care. When we started the survivorship program, I think we were one of the first in the area to do this. And also at Hopkins, there was something that was done in childhood cancers, but nothing has been done on the survivorship arena with any of the other adult cancers. So we developed a folder of information that we were giving out to patients about kind of the next steps after treatment and looking at some of these survivorship issues. And we've, and I've kind of said, we're not copywriting that information. We don't want it to unique to us. And so I get frequent calls from places around the country of people saying, we want to start a survivorship program. We don't know how. And I kind of give a very quick spiel about, you start where you are, make connections with people in the community, and that doesn't necessarily have to be at the cancer center that you work at. Here's some educational material that we've created. Feel free to use it. Give out what you want. Take what you want and leave the rest, is kind of what I say to them all the time. And start small and grow. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing, is you got to start somewhere and then grow these programs. So I feel like we're very fortunate that we've had a lot of institutional buy-in at Hopkins and a lot of wonderful support that's helped this program grow. And I think that it's going to only continue to grow as we go forward. And we've been very lucky, not just at Hopkins, but in the community, there's been great support from our colleagues.
It's terrific that something is out there now, and you've gone leaps and bounds in the last 6 years. We're recording this on September the 15th, 2014. Mm-hmm. And my question to you is, how is Alyssa today?
Alyssa's great. Alyssa's busier than ever. You know, I don't sleep a lot, and I'm really busy. October's coming up, which is a big thing in Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
Kids just went back to school.
My daughter started. My younger daughter started kindergarten. My older daughter is in high school. Which is great.
High school. Huh?
High school.
She's how old now? 13?
She's 15.
Yeah. Oh my.
Yeah.
Now you got the teenage.
Yeah, I got both. Yeah. I keep telling my husband we're going to have babies every 11 years to have hope in humanity. So life is good, but it's, being busy is good. I often say it's a lot better to be looking at work than for work, but mm-hmm. it's, a lot of late nights, early mornings, and, which is great. You know, I feel like people are, there's a lot of need out there. So, you know, it's.
But you yourself, you're doing.
Yeah. Health wise, I'm great. So, good. I did a triathlon just a few weeks ago and, ran 5 miles this morning and, feel great.
Good. I've got to take a nap just listening to it.
Lots of energy, right?
Which is true.
I would say health-wise, I've never felt better. So, the other thing that I have found is that finding a balance in my life. And then there are some days where it's better than others, and
sure.
I'm not really good at setting good boundaries in terms of work life, but I'm not sure who is. So,
like everybody.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's good. It's like I said, I've never felt healthier.
I'm glad to hear that. Anything else you want to add?
No, I think we've covered it.
Like I said, it's a good introductory here, and I like to keep it as an ongoing relationship and collaboration,
that would be
wonderful. And I hope you enjoyed doing this.
Yeah, it's been fun. Really fun.
So you'd like to give some contact info out?
Sure. So my email address is ebantug1, so that's ebantug1 at jhmi.edu.
Great. Thank you very much. It's an amazing story from Alyssa Thorner Bantug. Thank you for being here on Baltimore Internet Radio.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
I've been talking to Alyssa Thorner Bantug, Program Manager of Breast Cancer Communication, Education, and Survivorship at the Johns Hopkins Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center. And I'm Dave Custy, your host for Healthcare and Its Future, here on Baltimore Internet Radio.